I think it's real light. It's light as we see today. But we're so used to thinking that light has to come from a specific source that many people think, well, the light source didn't exist, so therefore the Bible is wrong. That's looking at it all wrong. I think the light came from something. I don't know what it was. It wasn't until day four that that function was passed off to the sun and the moon and the stars, primarily the sun, I think, but there was this transference that took place at some point. How that happened, I don't think I can give you a physical explanation, but there are many aspects of creation itself which aren't physical, because I think the rules were different then than they are today, and what they were on day seven, let's say. Many people have speculated what the source was. One of the most common speculations is that the light came from God himself, because God is light, and that's usually taken as being metaphorical, but it could be taken literally in that sense. But also in the book of Revelation, we talk about the New Jerusalem and the fact that it says there will be no need of the light of the sun or the moon, because Jesus will light the place. It doesn't say there won't be a sun and a moon. It just simply says there will be no need of those objects. And there are a lot of parallels between the original creation and the final recreation of the next heaven and the next world, earth. And so I'm not dogmatic about it, but I find the argument compelling, given that bookend sort of aspect of the whole thing. That's kind of like a restitution of the original state, perhaps. So I have no quarrel with that majority explanation, but I like to leave it kind of open-ended. It could have been some other object, but I know for a fact it wasn't the sun, because the sun wasn't there yet. That help?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I talked about that COBE experiment from 89 to 91, and then it was followed up a few years ago by WMAP, that stood for Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe. And that one was had the sensitivity required by the homogeneities in the background radiation.
Yeah, and the big conclusion that came from that, I saw it in the news from Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, CBC, was that after they'd done all their taken all their data and collected it and summarized it and analyzed it, their conclusion was that the universe came into being in 1/1,000,000,000th of a second.
Yeah,
that's phenomenal. That's incredible.
Well,
and that should have been the front page news.
Yeah.
You
well,
know?
What they did is they took data from the WMAP. And actually from a few other experiments. And the thing you have to realize is those kind of results are extremely model dependent. It depends on using a Big Bang model and what particular version of the Big Bang model you use. If you change the version, change the parameters, then you're going to change the length of time, either up increase it or decrease it. So it comes across like, well, we just put the data in and out came the answer. Well, it's a little more complex than that, and it's extremely model dependent. And I don't think even a lot of astronomers understand that. I think because they take the model as being so given and so beyond any kind of discussion that it's just a given sort of thing.
I wonder if you could explain to us about the spirals on the spiral galaxies, and how long you would expect, from a creationist viewpoint, those spirals to last, and how, and whether or not you think the current Big Bang theory explains their persistence.
Okay, spiral structure I think I alluded to it in my presentation. It's a tricky thing. You see these beautiful spiral galaxies with a spiral pattern in it, and this was first noted really in the 19th century, but really starting in the 1920s and 30s. The problem is a lot of those photographs were black and white, and they were very blue sensitive. And there are a lot of very bright, hot blue stars lying along the spiral arms. And that accentuated the spiral arms. You'd almost get the impression by looking at the spiral arms, I thought this for a long time myself, is that there were scads of stars along the spiral arms and precious anything in between. But as it turns out, that's not quite true. If you do a census, if you start off from, say, the center of the galaxy and work your way out to the edge, passing through spiral arms and through gaps between the spiral arms, and you're just counting all the stars that you encountered, what you'd find is that the count would decrease gradually, but it wouldn't go up or down as you went through the spiral arms. That's because the multitude of stars, which are typically faint and red, are pretty uniformly distributed across the disk of the galaxy. And if you take less blue-sensitive photographs, say in the yellow or in the red or the infrared, the spiral arms get less and less and less pronounced. So when you get to the infrared, the spiral galaxies look like disks. You don't really see the spiral arms showing up at all. So the point I'm making is there's less to spiral arms than you might think that there are. The stars aren't really in abundance there. It's just the bright, hot stars. The other thing you find in abundance is an enhancement in the stuff between the stars, what we call the interstellar medium. It's very thinly distributed gas and dust particles, much higher vacuum than we could ever produce on the Earth. And it's very clumpy, and it tends to clump along the spiral arms. Now, early on, from, say, the 1930s into the 1960s, astronomers were kind of misled by that appearance, and they thought the spiral arms were basically locations of stars, perhaps. And obviously, if these things are rotating under the influence of gravity, the inner portions will go faster than the outer portions. And within a few hundred million years, you'd probably smear out that spiral structure. Less than a billion years, it would just kind of disappear. Yet galaxies are supposed to be 10 and 12 billion years old. Why do we have spiral structure? In the 1960s, they suggested that it was a density enhancement in the interstellar medium, and it triggered star formation. And that's where you got the hot, bright stars. This was called spiral density wave theory. It was kind of a kludgy model that really didn't work that well. You had so many parameters you had to set, and it didn't come out naturally. Then by the 90s, they were saying it was perturbations of nearby satellite galaxies, and now they're saying dark matter is somehow mediating it. So the whole point is the evolutionary model, if you will, is arguing that the thing is agitated somehow by some unknown force at this point. Again, we're back to epicycles, I think. You're trying to invoke all sorts of explanations here. So I think, I've gone around a long way to say this, I think that spiral structure is still a difficulty for billions of year old galaxies out there. But we need to at least recognize the fact that evolutionists have attempted to come up with explanations why it persists. And I think a good discussion of that ought to at least tip the hat or even mention those possibilities, even though they likely won't work. Does that help? All right. Kind of long-winded, but I wanted to kind of lay out the foundation on that.
What do you think of the idea of star nurseries? Do stars, are they formed? The kinetic energy of the gas pressures negate the coalescing power of gravity.
All right. Some creationists think that stars don't form today because they say that God created finished the creation. At the end of the creation week and said it's complete. But stars do disintegrate. They quote unquote die, if you wish. I mean, Ken Ham wouldn't like saying we die because when were they ever alive? He would say, but they do meet with some sort of destruction. Even creationists agree with that concept. And so horses and dogs and cats all die, and they're replaced with new ones. And nobody says that's a violation of the "it is finished" on the creation sort of end. So, as a creationist, my mind is not totally closed to stars perhaps forming today. Now, having said that, what you have are stars, and then you have big gas clouds. And they look very different, but when you compare the two and think about it, a gas cloud is big, it's massive, very rarefied, very cold, very low pressure. But if you compressed it down and made the gas cloud about the size of a star, the temperature would go up, the density would go up, and in short, everything that is different from a gas cloud and a star would suddenly wipe away and you'd have a star. And so astronomers long ago said, aha, maybe gas clouds contract to form stars. And they said, how could that happen? Well, gravity can make it happen. These things do possess gravity. But, as you already alluded to in your question, all the clouds we see and we've measured are what we say stable against collapse. If you start to crunch them down just a little bit, the pressure increases and pushes it back out. They're in hydrostatic equilibrium. And a fellow named Sir James Jeans back in the 20s or 30s did a calculation, and the calculation still holds, I think, or some variation of it, that showed that if you take a gas cloud of a given mass and temperature and composition, you have to compress the gas cloud down to a minimum size called the Jeans length. And once you get it down to that size, then gravity will take over and contract it down. But all the gas clouds we see are many orders of magnitude larger than the Jeans length. When I say an order of magnitude, I'm talking about a factor of 10. So it's not like if it's off by a factor of 3 or 4, maybe you could spit and slide it under the door. But we're talking off factors of millions or billions. I mean, they're just not even close to that. And so astronomers have devised these processes where you can jumpstart the process, get a gas cloud crunched down to the Jeans length or something close to that. And one of the most popular ones is that you have a supernova go off nearby. It produces a shock wave, gas moving along, a big wall of it about a couple thousand kilometers per second, slams into this gas cloud and starts to contract it down. And I'm convinced that might work in some circumstances. Does anybody see the problem with that? Yeah, what's a supernova? It's an exploding star. So where did this star? Well, this star came from a gas cloud, and there was a supernova that happened over here that crunched it down and formed a star. Okay, so that solves the problem, right? Well, where did that star come from? And ultimately, you've got a chicken and egg problem, don't you? It may tell us where some stars come from today, but it ultimately doesn't tell us where stars originally came from. We know where people come from, right? But that doesn't tell us where the first people came from. That's the absurdity of it all there. And so all the other explanations I've seen out there are even worse. One dealing with dust particles cooling the clouds requires that a minimum of two generations of stars first exist. So that's even worse than this other one. So it's a chicken and egg sort of problem. I think they can kind of tell us where stars might come from today. But they can't tell us where they ultimately come from. And I love this. The evidence they're finding in distant galaxies is that not long after the Big Bang, there was this flurry of star formation that suddenly swept across the universe. Just unbelievable star formation rates that we've never seen since then, dropped precipitously. And all of that star formation, high rate of star formation, happened from some unknown process. And you're snickering, but scientists, astronomers believe this with a straight face. They look right in the eye, and they don't bat an eye. They really believe this stuff, and that's truly amazing. One last comment, as I mentioned, that I'm open to the idea of stars perhaps forming today. I am thoroughly convinced that if it does happen, it's not nearly as common as most astronomers think or require it to be. I gave some wiggle room there. It might or it might not. It doesn't really matter. It's not significant. I'll put it that way. You like that answer? All right.
One community that is referenced a few times in the CMI's articles is the electric plasma community. Mm-hmm. And I read a book called The Electric Sky. I'm interested in them because, kind of like the creation community, they're a fringe community. And it gives you another perspective on what we receive from media and journals and so on. What is your perspective of that community? For instance, they say that astronomers in general are trying to use gravity to explain everything, not paying attention to the fact that we know a lot about electricity, that satellite data and experiments with those two things, they can explain the structure of everything we see in outer space. They can't say where it comes from, but they can describe the structure, why the spiral galaxies exist, and so on. And they don't have to use hypothetical things like dark energy, like inflation, and so on.
I've been looking at this very recently. You mentioned the book, The Electric Sky. I got a copy of that book recently. I'm about a third of the way through it. I'm making notes as I go through. I'm not impressed. I have a lot of problems with what I've read in the first third of the book. Some things which I think are poorly stated, things I think are just plain wrong. Like, for instance, you say that, you know, the astronomers are transfixed with gravity explaining everything. I think the plasma people are transfixed with electromagnetic effects explaining everything. And it's not true that astronomers ignore electromagnetic effects. I mean, it's really thrown into the models quite a bit. Black hole, for instance, that's got a lot of electromagnetic effects, plasma effects associated with it. Solar wind, the solar corona, even parts of the solar interior, those are all electromagnetic. So we don't ignore those. The big question is that on the big scale, do electromagnetic effects have the dominant force involved here? And I think the currents required and the magnetic fields required to drive these are tremendous, you know, very large amounts of magnetic fields that are required. And we have measured magnetic fields in the interstellar medium. We've measured magnetic fields in other galaxies. And it's a fraction of what would be required for the plasma model. So I'm still looking at it. I haven't finished the book, and I really need to go through that more, and I plan to write up my comments on it when I finish that. But I am looking at it. The other aspect is the fact that I was first made aware of the plasma model in the early 90s from the Eric Lerner's book, The Big Bang Never Happened. And what strikes me from that is that the plasma model is put together by a group of atheists and agnostics who reject the Big Bang for maybe different reasons from you or I, and they want to replace the Big Bang with a modified version of the steady state, which I didn't mention tonight. I don't even mention it that much anymore because it's not really a relevant model. It hasn't been since the 60s. But that is an eternal model. It's an eternal. There's no beginning and no end. And as bad as the Big Bang model is, I think the eternal universe is even worse. It really is even worse if you look at it. And I'm concerned that some creationists are taking what I think is a patently atheistic model, and they're trying to baptize it and make it their own. And I think it's a little problematic to do that. Does that help?
Sure.
All right.
Sure.
One of the things he mentions, it just seems common sense to me, is that sometimes we'll read in articles about magnetic loops, and they just point out there's no such thing. It's the lines we draw on paper just illustrate a force that's emanating, and there's no ability to have a broken magnetic loop.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a number of other things that just seem common sense to me. And so that's, to some degree, another reason why it was somewhat appealing to me. I guess that's not a question. It's
all
more
right.
of a
that's
comment.
That's a comment. Okay. That's fine.
What do you think of Halton Arp wrote a book, The Redshift Controversy, believing that, well, he's got a whole catalog.
That's a very bitter book, by the way.
I haven't read the book. I've only read articles.
He really bears a soul there. He was really offended and hurt by his treatment. But go ahead.
Well, he's got a catalog of pictures that show galaxies, and in front of the galaxies are objects that are supposed to be much, much, much further away.
Right.
And so he also shows pictures with dust trails from a galaxy to a quasar, I guess.
Right.
And he believes he's seeing star and galaxy formation.
Right. He thinks that quasars are ejected from galaxies nearby rather than being very distant objects, and that this represents the creation event of matter required in this original steady state model, continuous creation models. The universe expands. You have to introduce new matter to take the place of matter that's getting less and less dense. And they used to just have it pop into existence uniformly, but ARP has suggested over the last couple of decades that there are injection sites where large amounts of matter is kicked in, and that is what the quasars are. That is a very fanciful sort of suggestion to me. You don't get any blue shifted objects. You have to kind of, you know, play games with the data to argue why none of them are blue shifted. They're all red shifted. And again, it's tied to a steady state model. Apart from the steady state model, it doesn't make a lot of sense, at least not to me at this point. ARP's work, and it's misunderstood by so many people. A lot of people think that ARP rejects all redshifts being cosmological, that is, the universe expanding. And the thing, he believes in an expanding universe. He is just opposed to the slavish devotion to redshifts almost always, at least large redshifts, always meaning expansion. And I think some of the data that he has are very difficult to handle. There's one particular galaxy I like quite a bit. It's a small galaxy with another galaxy, and looks like it's in front of it. It's got like, taken a bite out of the one behind it, looks like, and yet the one in front that's taken the bite out of the more distant one has a redshift 10 times larger than the background object, which the redshifts would suggest the other direction. So what are you going to believe, what the redshifts will tell you or what you can see with your own two eyes, with apologies to Groucho Marx. So MARP is a mixed bag. I think he's got a lot of interesting things that are difficult and impossible to explain. Other things, I think maybe he's leaned on the statistics himself, like quasar statistics around galaxies, find them clustering. He looks for these blue objects and he just assumes they're quasars, but it's never been really confirmed by detailed analysis that they really are quasars, so maybe his statistics are a little skewed in that. So there's a big argument there. They did shut ARP down to over 20 years ago, and I think that was a travesty. That's not the way to do science.
So I hear you saying that you believe some of those things may be,
yep,
as they look in front of,
yep,
others that are...
At least one object I've seen, I find it irrefutable when I look at it. Others, like the connections between some of the galaxies, like Markarian 205 is his most famous one, and I just don't see the connection there on that one. I think it may be a bleed over from the exposure. But it's not a real good example, even though that seems to be Exhibit A that he and other people use. But some are easy to get rid of. Others are very difficult to get rid of.
What about the dust and matter trails that go from a galaxy to...
Those look good. I think that you've got this galaxy sitting here, and you've got an arm going out, and all of a sudden there's a right turn. It goes off in a weird direction, and at the end of it there's a more distant galaxy. And the standard model would have this one very... very far behind, and this just lined up with it. And the thing is, you could occasionally have those, and maybe ARP is looking for this. He's cherry picking his data, is what many people would say. He finds these odd things, but he doesn't look for the mundane ones. And so if you ignore all the mundane ones and poke out all the odd ones, suddenly the world looks weirder than it really is. So you got to be careful with selection effects. That's not the best argument either. I think there's some legitimacy there, but you've got to be careful how you interpret and handle the data.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Dr. Faulkner, I'm just wondering if you can give us your opinion of Russell Humphrey's cosmological model, and also could you give us an update on the quantization of the redshift of galaxies?
Okay. Russ is a good friend of mine, and we've discussed his models many times. I've come up with my own explanation to the light travel time problem in the last couple of years. I've discussed it with Russ, and what we're arguing is very similar in a lot of particulars, but a little different in some fundamentals. And he's wanted to get me on board for a long time. I've been kind of holding at arm's length a little bit because I have a few reservations about it, but I think that Russ has really blazed the trail, showing us the kind of work we ought to be doing. He had the first serious explanation for the light travel time problem, and whether his stuff pans out or not, I do tip my hat for him taking the time to do the work that we all ought to be doing. So he's a real pioneer and a good man for doing that. On many days, I think it's the best explanation we have. A lot of other creation astronomers and physics type, they really like his explanation. I like it a little less, I guess. I think the last time we talked about it, I said I dislike all the solutions out there, but I dislike yours the least. And he was amused to no end by that one. And as far as the other question you had was the quantization of redshifts. You look at galaxies and the redshifts that they have, according to from the expansion of the universe for the most part, and you would expect that the values of the redshifts would have all values, continuous, we would say, in mathematics. And a guy named Tift, starting back in 1976, I think, began publishing papers where he found that they don't occur random distributions, but instead are, if you do a histogram, and by the way, you have to correct them. It doesn't come out of the raw data. You have to correct the motions for our motion around the galaxy. You correct everything that you measure to the center of the solar system, to the sun, but then beyond that, you need to make our motion as we orbit around. So if you take the raw data, it gets smeared out because we're moving like 250 kilometers per second around the galaxy. But if you correct that the way we're supposed to, and if we have that amount of correction, then it should be a very smooth thing. If you plot the histogram is the frequency of numbers versus the quantity, in this case the redshift, what you find is that it tends to peak at several values. The most common value of the peaking, I believe, is around 36 and 72 kilometers per second. 72 primarily, but sometimes 36 and multiples of that. And lest you think it's an absolute quantization like you have with atoms and the electrons, it's not like, you know, bumping down up to zero and back up again. It's kind of ripples like this. There are a lot of exceptions in between. So there can't be, you can't make an exact analog to quantization of energy as you have in quantum systems. But the most straightforward interpretation, if you take the understanding of the expansion of the universe as being the cause of these redshifts, the most simple, straightforward explanation is that we're sitting very close to the center of a bunch of concentric shells of galaxies, because redshift means distance. So if you have a clumping of redshift, you have a clumping of distance, and that would be a shell here and another shell and another shell. And if we're sitting at the center of a bunch of concentric shells of galaxies, that looks like we're in a preferred location at some place in the universe, a very special location, not just at the center of the universe, because people question whether there is such a thing, but we're at the center of these shells of matter. And that just blows people away, because if the universe looks like that, and no model I'm aware of today out there taken seriously in cosmological circles would suggest a thing that you have concentric shells, what's the probability we'd be anywhere near the center? Just vanishingly small. And so most astronomers kind of ignore it, and nobody knows what to make of it. Creationists Russ Humphreys thinks that, you know, we are in a series of concentric shells thrown out. So it's kind of a natural thing you might expect from his model. You wouldn't necessarily predict it, but it's easy to explain or understand, whereas it makes absolutely no sense in any of the other cosmologies, any Big Bang or steady state model. Absolutely not. And that's the reason why astronomers generally ignore it. And they've told Tift over the years, they said, well, that's interesting, but we think you did your statistics wrong. Try doing this. And so he goes and he does this. Said, thank you. It actually strengthens the case. And then they say, well, you need a larger sample size. Okay, and he goes out and he does another sample size, bigger sample size, and it strengthens the case. Every time they tell him you've done this wrong, he goes and does it, and it makes the case even better. It won't go away. But what you do with things is you just ignore them if they don't make sense to you. Sure, yeah. He's published it in the Astrophysical Journal, which is the most prestigious astronomy journal. I haven't looked at a lot of the references, but they've published it elsewhere, but it's definitely in the Astrophysical Journal.
Has anybody tried to refute?
Oh, yeah, they've tried refuting it. You know, telling you did your statistics wrong, your sample size is wrong, but every time he takes a criticism, it actually makes the case better. It doesn't go away. Everyone criticizes him thinking, well, I'll take care of it, and then it doesn't. It's like taking your car to an auto mechanic and he says, well, you need this, and he fixes it, and it still has a problem. You kick it back, well, you need to do that, and you take it back, still has a problem. It keeps getting worse and worse, and the mechanic, you know, can't fix it after 10 trips to the mechanic. What are you going to do? Go to another mechanic and get an attorney, probably. You know, but you're not. You've got a problem here you can't fix.
You have to wonder why this isn't on the front cover of Time.
Well, you know, those little anomalies are on the sides and places, and when things don't fit the paradigm, you ignore it, and that's been the nature of science all along. And eventually, those anomalies accumulate to the point that it becomes hard to ignore anymore. And I have no idea what to make of quantized redshifts. I really don't. I find it interesting. And if it's real, and I think it is, then it's very significant. If you ignore that, then you're probably missing such a fundamental important thing, you can't possibly get a right cosmological model out of it. We're done?
We're done.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Faulkner, for that, and thank all of you for coming.